So again, welcome everyone. I apologize in advance. There's the neighbors, they're using a little power equipment somewhere. Hopefully it won't be happening a lot, but if you hear a little noise, so I've got Zoom set for background noise suppression. So hopefully that works fairly well. Can you hear me okay? Yeah, great. And I'm also here at home with just me and my doggy Kiku, because my wife's on her way back from Canada at the moment. So if my dog jumps up and starts barking, he does that sometimes. But hopefully he's taking a nap right now. Hopefully he'll continue napping. Yeah. So I think I'm actually going to speak for just a little bit about what we're doing today, and then I'll lead a practice, and then I'll probably share just a little more, and then we'll move into Q&A. So George mentioned these five neural networks. So I've been studying and practicing meditation with great passion and interest and curiosity for more than 50 years now, across all traditions, primarily in the Tibetan Vajrayana tradition and the Zen tradition. But I've studied everything you can imagine and worked with a lot of teachers in different traditions and continue to do so. It's really my passion. And for the last two or three decades, I've also been exploring neuroscience very deeply. And most recently, really working with integrating classic meditation techniques and yogic and contemplative science with the emerging field of network neuroscience. And network neuroscience is the science of how the neural networks in the brain interact with each other. And we tend to, you know, naturally be a little bit reductionist. Now we think about things a little mechanical. So we may tend to think of the brain like a kind of a circuit board that's got all these circuits and they connect with each other and so forth and do amazing things. And that's valid to a degree. And the brain is also very fluid. It's a very fluid universe, and the communication and the energy is moving about in the brain like waves. And it's like an incredible symphony that can either be in a beautiful harmonic state, like a, you know, really beautifully conducted and played symphony, or can move into chaos and dissonance, or can move into rigidity and stuckness. Right? But when the brain is functioning optimally, it's really a flow, and a beautiful flow of energy and constant transfer of information. Nonetheless, having said that, we can talk about these particular neural pathways. And there are many different neural pathways in the brain, and they connect different parts of the brain. Many of them connect some of the same parts, and they interact with each other in various ways. And I'm going to talk about five neural networks in particular that have a lot to do with the practice of meditation and with our overall, with healing and with spiritual development, spiritual evolution, and even awakening. So the first one is the attention network. And that's fairly obvious. With any kind of mindfulness awareness practice, we're training ourselves to be able to intentionally or consciously shift our attention from one thing to another. So normally we place our attention on an object of attention or an object of mindfulness, like the body or the breath. And when we notice that our attention has wandered, we gently bring it back. Wanders again, we bring it back. And in doing so, we're actually developing a more robust attention network, which means it has more neural connections, more axons, more dendrites. It becomes actually physically more robust. Then the next one is the self-regulation network. And this is the network that regulates the autonomic nervous system. And most of you are probably familiar with that system. It has an upregulating branch, the sympathetic branch, which helps with alertness, but can go beyond that into stress and into fight or flight and panic. And then the parasympathetic branch, which is often related to relaxation, rest and digest and so forth. They're both happening all the time, and they're connected with the breath. When we breathe in, there's a slight activation of the sympathetic, the alertness, and when we breathe out, slight activation of the parasympathetic, the rest and digest, which is why with various breath techniques, we can learn to regulate our own autonomic nervous system. And when we practice regulation a lot, that network becomes more robust and it tends to work on its own so that our nervous system stays in a more regulated state most of the time, more and more so. Then there's the related emotion regulation network. And this is does just what it says, regulates our emotions, our emotional energy. And with a robust emotion regulation network, we're able to feel our emotions. This is not about repressing emotions at all. We're able to feel them and experience the wisdom in our emotions without being hijacked by them, right? Without being hijacked. And we're actually much more tuned in. And to this practice we'll be doing today, we're much more tuned into the emotional body. So we know the subtle shifts in mood and emotion before they have to kind of hit us over the head and hijack us with a strong emotional upheaval of some kind. So that's the emotion regulation network. Then you have the task positive network. And the task positive network regulates the default mode network. The default mode network is responsible for that chatterbox between our ears. It loves to time travel into the past and ruminate about the past, loves to time travel into the future and worry about the future, fantasize about the future, keeps a running commentary about the sort of imagined present, which isn't really the present, and is forming all of our opinions and constantly thinking about myself and what others think about me. And it's creating that, constantly reinforcing that limited self, sense of self, limited self perspective. And it's really the source of our kind of narcissistic tendencies. I have to be very self-focused. Now, I don't mean to demonize the default mode network because it has a very important role, and it's really a source of tremendous creativity when we can free it from fear and anxiety. But because of the negativity bias and survival is job one for any species, we pay more attention to threat than anything else. Our long-term memory is full of experiences of threat and negativity and danger. Develops implicit memory. We tend to spin things to the negative, and thus our long-term memory tends to be negative until we work to rewire our brain otherwise. And so if we just let our mind wander, more often than not, it wanders to the negative, wanders to stress and anxiety. And the default mode network is active when we just let the mind do what it wants. We just let it wander, right? So if we can do that absent the fear and anxiety, then that becomes the source of tremendous creativity and really the source for a lot of artists and musicians and scientists solving problems, and in psychoanalysis, it's the modality of free association. But again, it requires a sense of safety so that it can become that source of creativity instead of just a source of further stress and anxiety and constant reinforcement of a sense of separation in the very limited self. So when we try to meditate, especially when we're beginners, what makes it difficult is that overactive default mode network. And most of us modern humans, it is extremely overactive. Right? And struggling with it, and I'm sure most of you know, doesn't work. And some people get the idea that meditation is about stopping your thoughts. Well, it doesn't work, and it's counterproductive to even try. So, and it just creates more stress and tension when we struggle with our thoughts. The classic instruction is just to let our thoughts be, just let them come and go. It's true of our entire experience. We're developing equanimity and just allowing our experience to be as it is, our whole sensory experience, cognitive experience, and emotional experience. When we activate the task positive network, which is activated when we direct our attention, then the default mode network naturally goes offline. These two networks have a mutually inhibitory or mutually antagonistic relationship. So you bring the task positive network online, default mode network starts to go offline, and the mind quiets down by itself. And the most efficacious way that I've found to activate the task positive network, especially to have a continual activation of the task positive network, is to work with becoming deeply embodied, feeling sensation in the body ever more deeply. This provides a continual activation of the task positive network, and thus we not only experience our mind quieting, but we experience our attention stabilizing, and over time developing deep attention stabilization. That was the robustness of the attention network. And that's the portal then into deeper states of awareness and even the deepest states of flow and in the Eastern traditions, samadhi, that kind of idea. So, and along the way, the body is learning to do this. The nervous system, the brain is learning how to do this. So we can move from intentional effortful self-regulation on mindfulness, which where all practice begins, to auto-regulation and effortless mindfulness awareness. And that's very important because to drop into the deeper states, we need to relax ever more. And at some point, effort can get in the way. So by using the body as the primary anchor and going deeper and deeper in the body, we're transforming our neural architecture such that the brain nervous system has ready access to attention stabilization, ready access to deeper states of awareness and flow, and we can relax even further with effortless practice into the deepest states of samadhi, which are profoundly healing and regulating and empowering and can lead to various forms of awakening. The final network, the fifth one, is the empathy connection network. And it turns out that all, the other four, which are all interconnected, so reinforcing one reinforces the other in certain ways, and there's a synergistic impact. It's like 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 isn't four, it's more like 108 or something. There's this synergistic impact, and all of them contribute to then having an empathy connection network that's more robust and more resilient, which allows us to connect with others and create safety and connection and appropriate intimacy depending on the relationship with others. And then that also continues to reinforce the strength and robustness of the other networks. So that's the five neural networks. And if you imagine someone who's always in a very regulated state, it's all but very, very difficult for something to trigger them out of a fairly harmonic state of regulation. Their emotions, they really are tuned into their emotional life. They experience their emotional life very deeply, but it's well-regulated. They're not being hijacked by their emotions. They're attentive. They're present. Their mind is very spacious, and they're very relational. They have their social engagement system in polyvagal terms online all the time. They're very open and relational and so forth. Well, that begins to sound like a fairly self-actualized, fairly enlightened person to some degree, right? And so we can actually accelerate this path of human evolution and development to our higher abilities of self-actualization and self-transcendence and the realization of deeper or higher consciousness. So that's the prelude to this. So now let's jump in and do some of it. Okay, so I invite you to find a posture that for you feels relatively upright, uplifted, awake, and at the same time relaxed and stable. And if for any reason of physical limitations, you need to do the practice lying down or standing up or leaning against the back of a chair for support, that's perfectly fine. Do what works for you. And if you are able to sit with a relatively upright posture, extending the crown of your head towards the ceiling or the sky a bit, that can be helpful. Let your rest of your body just relax around that, the arms hanging loosely in the shoulder sockets, and just bring your hands up, let them naturally just fall in your upper legs where they fall. So sitting with an alert, uplifted, awake, relaxed posture. You could open your or part your lips just slightly, which will relax the jaw a bit, and the breath will move freely through the nose and the mouth. You can also place your tongue on the upper palate if you like, kind of restrict salivation, connect some internal circuitry, and that way you'll be breathing primarily through the nose unless your nasal passages are blocked, even with the lips parted slightly. Now, that's getting in the way of your usual practice. Just do what you're used to is fine. But however you're used to setting up your practice, your posture. And then for this practice session, I invite you to close your eyes. The reason being that connecting with the internal landscape of tactile physical sensation is very important to this approach. And that may be easier to do with your eyes closed. Ultimately, you can do the practice with the eyes open, and I teach both eyes open and eyes closed practice. And for this session, I would invite you to close your eyes if that's comfortable for you so that you can really feel into the body. And to begin with, I invite you to just begin Begin to feel whatever actual sensations are most prominent for you in the moment. Might be the sensations arising at the contact points between your body and the cushion or the chair, whatever your sitting arrangement is, between your feet and the ground. Could be the contact with your skin and your clothing, the texture of your clothing, the weight of your clothing. Could be sensations arising with the air temperature in the room where you are, or any movement of the air, as well as the passage of air across the nostrils and your parted lips with each in-breath and out-breath. And I invite us to make a gentle effort to feel the actual micro sensations that make up this experience we call breath and body. Breath and body are both just words or concepts, but they point to a moment-to-moment lived experience, a sensate experience. So the actual sensations are perhaps prickly sensations, tingling, pins and needles, sensations of pressure, warmth, coolness, aliveness, numbness, whatever you can actually feel, the actual sensations. And perhaps noticing how quickly the brain starts to replace direct experience with concept. So instead of actually feeling the sensations making up the breath, it says, oh, there's the breath. Or even if you're really tracking the sensations as the breath passes across the surface of the skin at the nostrils, as the breath flows in, flows out, pretty quickly the brain just goes, oh, in-breath, out-breath. Or even sensation itself is just a concept, just a word. So we're making a gentle effort to drop in and really feel the actual sensations in their great variety and diversity all across the surface of the skin to begin with. From head to toe, back sides and front. And doing so and somewhat connecting the dots with all these different sensations all across the surface of the skin, which is one vast sensory organ from head to toe, we may begin to feel somewhat enveloped in a sensate field, which is that sensate field that's the boundary between our body and the space surrounding us. And though we generally regard space as empty, we know actually it's atmospheric, made up of gases, it's tangible, we can feel it. And I invite us to regard that space as benevolent and to feel held by that space. So it's almost like with our attention and our awareness, we're weaving together from head to toe, back, sides, and front, scalp, soles of the feet, a kind of womb-like structure of benevolent sensate experience in which we can relax further and feel embraced and held in the same way that a child, an infant, is held by their mother or father. And then within that, you're invited to begin exploring the internal landscape of actual tactile sensations. Now, as we move into the body, if any of my guidance takes you into a place that doesn't feel workable for you, please feel completely empowered to redirect your attention somewhere else in the body, or even to open your eyes and direct your attention outside of the body if you need to do that. Please be completely empowered to take care of yourself and do what works for you. And the invitation is to lean in a little bit, to explore. So to begin with, I invite you to notice your breathing, to feel yourself breathing. Feeling the sensations of the diaphragm muscle contracting and relaxing, as well as the abdominal muscles, the intercostal muscles between the ribs, that flow of actual sensations, belly rising and falling, and rib cage opening and closing. And in particular, I invite you to notice and feel at the end of the out-breath a release that allows the body to breathe in. And then at the end of the in-breath, a release that allows you to breathe out. So the best of your ability, focus on really feeling that release at the end of the out-breath and the end of the in-breath that transitions from out to in and in to out. Let's stay with that for just a moment and let really feeling that as deeply as you can bring you deeper into the body, to feeling the body and into the moment. And for now, having that felt feeling of that release at the end of the out-breath, at the end of the in-breath, be sort of the primary marker. That's you're staying on track with that. Also, just letting your awareness expand into the entire inner landscape of the body, realizing that the entire body is sensory, all the way down to the bones and including the bones, all containing neuronal cells, all connected to the central nervous system. And all of these internal sensations flow through a particular set of neural networks to the brain, different from those on the surface of the skin. And they're subtler than external sensations, but nonetheless very experiential. And you can go deeper and deeper. So with that feeling, that release at the end of the out-breath, at the end of the in-breath is the sort of primary anchor, letting your awareness expand deeper and deeper into the entire human organism that we call body, which is a field of energy and information, a sensate field. And this can include sensations that are pleasant, neutral, unpleasant, sensations of pleasure, discomfort, with all the sensations of the breath, the heartbeat. Perhaps feeling your skeletal structure supporting you. Perhaps feeling the musculature connected to that. The musculature supporting the skeleton, the skeleton supporting the neck, the musculature, which allows us to sit upright. The activity of all of our organisms, this organs and so forth, this vast universe that is the most complex organism in the known universe, the human body, human nervous system, human brain. And as we feel ever deeper into the body, cultivating deep curiosity to know ourselves as deeply as possible, and as well, non-judgment, self-acceptance, and unbiased attitude. Just allowing our experience to just be as it is, and deeply curious to know yet another layer of depth. Deeply curious to have our awareness uncover another layer of depth, of embodiment, presence. And we find ourselves at all distracted, just coming back to that release at the end of the out-breath. That release at the end of the in-breath, letting that again bring you into the body, grounded in the body. And as we practice in this way, I'm going to invite you to contemplate three different things. We'll do them in order. So you're going to keep practicing in this deeply embodied way with curiosity, openness, non-judgment, feeling ever more deeply into the body, all the way down to the bones, while beginning to silently repeat certain phrases that are kind of a contemplation. And the first one is recognizing that right here, right now, at least for this moment, I'm safe. Right here, right now, I'm safe. So just start repeating a phrase, something like that. Right here, right now, I'm safe. And contemplating safety could bring up memories of not being safe or concerns about not being safe in the future. And that's fine. We let all that come and go. And just coming back to the fact that all that may be true, and at least for this moment, even this microsecond, I am safe, at least relatively safe. Right here, right now, I'm safe. Allowing ourselves to feel a moment of safety, to feel that in our nervous system, to feel it in our bones. So breathing that deep into the body, deep into the nervous system, deep into the bones. Right here, right now, I'm safe. I'm okay. Right here, right now, I'm safe, secure, okay, at least for this moment. And I could give myself a gift, the gift of feeling safe for a moment, relaxing that kind of vigilance that we've all been conditioned into, in many cases almost a hypervigilance, which is just part of the human condition and can be exacerbated in relation to certain professions or human experiences, but it's also part of the human condition, the survival instinct. We're just relaxing. Right here, right now, I'm safe. Right here, right now, I'm safe. Allowing yourself to feel a moment of deep okayness, safety, security, being held by that external sensate field, like the embrace of the mother or the father or the surrogate parent. And relaxing into that, right here, right now, I'm safe. And then building on that experience, the second contemplation is right here, right now, I'm resourced. Right here, right now, I'm resourced. I have what I need, food, warmth, shelter. So just keep repeating a phrase, something like right here, right now, I'm resourced. I'm resourced. I have what I need. And feel that quality of being resourced, which is the opposite of lack, obviously. And that could also bring up memories of not feeling resourced or concerns about not being resourced. And you can let all that come and go. We're not repressing anything. And keep redirecting your attention to the fact that right here, right now, I am resourced, at least for this moment. I am resourced, physically resourced, emotionally resourced. And acknowledging that as an adult, I know how to resource myself. And I can ask for help when I need it. Right here, right now, I'm resourced. Right here, right now, I'm resourced. Safe and resourced. Safe and resourced. Then building on the first two, the third contemplation is right here, right now, I'm connected. I'm connected. So bringing into your mind's eye your loved ones, your family members, your closest friends, really bring them into your mind's eye and feel the connection that you have with human beings who have your back, you have their back. It may not be perfect. We often have relational struggles and this or that, but we are connected. So feel that quality of being connected. We're all connected here in this Sangha Live session together. And we're connected to our own sanghas and communities at home. But really bringing into your mind's eye those who are closest to you, including pets. And feel that quality of connectedness. Feel it in your bones. Breathe it into your nervous system. Breathe it into your bones. Right here, right now, I'm connected. And of course, that could bring up feelings or fears of loneliness or disconnection. And again, we're not repressing anything. And just keep bringing your mind back to allowing yourself to feel a moment of connectedness. Right here, right now, I'm connected. Connected. Safe, resourced, and connected. safe, resourced, and connected. Safe, resourced, and connected. And you can begin to let those contemplations sort of dissolve back into the heart, into the body, and return to feeling the body as deeply as you can. Feeling the body as deeply as you can. Coming back to feeling that release at the end of the out-breath, that release at the end of the in-breath. And just being curious, how deeply can I feel my own body right now? How many layers of sensate experience, of energy, of information can I tap into and feel and open to in my own body, heart, and mind right now? The flow of aliveness, the flow of life force energy, the flow of the blood circulation. We are bioelectrical, chemical, life force, ki, chi, prana beings. And there's this continual flow of energy and information from head to toe. And it's also flowing out and connecting with the larger world and coming back in. So feeling that flow, feeling that aliveness. And feeling, coming back continually to feeling actual sensation. Being curious about our ability to stay in direct experience and relaxing even the sense of having an observer or a witness, just direct contact with sensation, direct sensing, in a sense, being the sensations, being the breath, being the body, completely coming home to the body, finding our way home to the body ever more deeply, which also connects us with our emotional body, ultimately connects us with the earth because we are earthlings, we're made of the earth. It's being curious, what can I feel? Actual sensations throughout the body, head to toe, bones, muscles, connective tissue, heartbeat, lymphatic system, circulatory system, the digestive processes, the organs, the glands, all the hormones, neurotransmitters, this continual flow of experience, the breath. As we feel ever more deeply into the body, it naturally anchors our attention, the mind quiets, whatever degree. And if there's still thoughts coming and going, just let them come and go. Whatever is arising in your experience, cognitively, emotionally, physically, sensory experience, just let it all come and go. No bias, no preference, but just being with and feeling. Often practice has a quality of witnessing, which is where we begin, very important, but here it's more about feeling. It's more about feeling. And allowing ourselves to simply be just as we are. So it's really a quality of being and feeling. Being and feeling. Feeling and being. Feeling and being. Being and feeling. And the more we drop into this deep quality of embodiment with awareness, all the internal energetic systems of the body begin to cohere. All the different aspects of our human organism emit energy at different wave frequencies. We have our brain waves, we have the frequency of our heartbeat, we have our breath, breaths per minute and so forth. But all the organs emit energy. Every aspect of the body, we are an energetic being, and these wave frequencies begin to cohere, they map onto each other, and we feel that as a palpable presence, a flow, and aliveness. And we can further ground our awareness and our attention in that flow of presence, aliveness, beingness. Being and feeling. Feeling and being. Being and feeling. Feeling and being. At least for the moment, nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to prove, nothing to evaluate or compare, simply being. Feeling and being, being and feeling. And in the depth of being, being open to feeling that unmistakable wholeness in the depth of our being, unmistakable goodness, okayness, the recognition that we're not broken, that we don't need fixing. We may have all the challenges we have, but underneath that, it's like dropping deep into the ocean. You might have a storm or very choppy waves on the surface, but you drop not too far down and it's still and whole, and our being is similar to that. So allowing yourself to experience that deep, deep wholeness, goodness, flow, feeling and being, being and feeling. In a moment, not yet, but in a moment, I'm going to invite us to gently open our eyes and to do our best to stay with this quality of feeling and being, being and feeling. And if we're able to reach up and turn on our camera if it's off, and then just smile so we can all connect with each other from this place of being and feeling. Feeling and being, deep sense of okayness, safe, resourced, and connected. Well, as you're ready, you can go ahead and open your eyes, turn on your camera if you're able to, give someone a smile, connect with someone. Just feel that quality of connection, community, sangha. You can look at some of the beautiful faces. You can look up the camera so people can see you looking directly into the camera. And then maybe you can look down at some of the faces. So looking around, connecting, smiling, and staying with this quality of being and feeling, feeling and being, being and feeling, feeling and being. Deep sense of okayness, beingness, connectedness. And I invite you through the rest of our session to keep coming back to that quality of beingness and of feeling. And to really being in the body. Even as we're involved in dialogue and so forth. You know, our Western culture has become one of almost extreme disembodiment. And to some degree, it's the human condition. Because we have these super computers on our shoulders. And we can get very fascinated with all our higher cognitive abilities. And the world is so amazing, so, you know, focusing outward. And of course, in modern culture, we've created all kinds of entertainments of all kinds of digital and video sorts. But this started a long time ago. I re really is the human condition. Even Plato was in ancient Greece was very fascinated with the brain and the mind and the higher cognitive abilities, and really said that's the divine. And there was just some kind of disassociation with the body. And Western culture became very disconnected from the body, and thus disconnected from the earth, and further so with the Cartesian split and so forth. But it's not just Western culture. Asian culture and Vedic culture, often in some of the deep yogic traditions, there was almost a demonization of the body. And after, not completely, but in an effort to overcome things like lust and passion, especially in sort of celibate traditions of yogis and so forth, there was like regard the body as just bag of actually shit, was what they would say. And it was to try to help people not be attached to physical form. And it was this kind of transcendent approach, right? Not completely. But even throughout the world's contemplative traditions, there's always been this back and forth between transcendence and immanence. And of course, now we have a global culture of modernity all around the world, which is very disconnected. Now, in thinking about this in kind of global terms, we have, Western culture, the emergence of Western science and that whole paradigm of materialism. And we have the Eastern sciences, traditional Eastern science, which was less materialistic, more like a kind of idealism and pantheism, but it really saw consciousness as primary. Whereas in the West, we're like consciousness, we know we have it, but we don't even know how it occurs from a reductionist, materialist, Western scientific point of view. Somehow this very complicated neurological activity of the brain, somehow this consciousness appears. We have no idea how. That's called the hard problem of consciousness. Now, of course, many Western scientists have gone deeper than that, but still there's no real affirmation in Western scientific terms. So from the Western viewpoint, the body, the material world is primary, and then somehow consciousness emerged. Consciousness is considered an emerging quality. And in the East, it's more like the material world emerges from consciousness. So you have those two. And then you have the indigenous worldview, which is another worldview altogether. And it's not that you can just say there's one and, universal indigenous, but there is a commonality to the indigenous worldview. And it tends to be very immanent, very earthbound, very connected to the body, connected to the earth, and connected to the deep feminine. Whereas both the Western and Eastern tendencies to transcendence moved connecting with the sky gods and the masculine and so forth. And it's not that there's anything wrong with any of this, it's just a question of balance. So in many ways, indigenous cultures represent more of that balance for us. And especially when indigenous people lived in very protected surroundings, right, in the natural world, and they didn't have the illusory protection or comfort of our homes and cars and all the rest of it, and we couldn't control the environment. So if you're out in the world and you don't control the temperature, you don't control the environment, you maybe have limited shelter and there are dangers, then you need to be awake, you need to be alive, you need to be connected to your body, connected to the earth, right? And so it's a very different situation. Of course, in modern culture, most indigenous peoples are also impacted by modern culture, although many are able to retain their ways. And because this deeper wisdom is even embedded into the linguistics of their language, the indigenous people tend to have greater access to this more deeply balanced view than many of us other modern folks have. And that's, I'm not meaning to make any assumptions, but this is based on my conversation with many indigenous elders. And, well, I've had the pleasure of interviewing for our many summits from South America and North America primarily, and a little bit from Africa and from Hawaii as well. Right? So, nonetheless, for most of us Westerners, what we're experiencing is this deep disembodiment, and then that ripples out into really all the impacts that we see on the environment, the ways we relate with each other, all the conflict, the war, the aggression. And it's really a world of disconnection a profound disconnection. And in some ways, it's inevitable. It's just an inevitable evolution of the human journey. And each of us, I think, goes through that. I think it's a human journey to first, you know, get connected with this incredible brain and develop greater levels of self-awareness and so forth. But somehow, if we're able to, you know, at some point recognize that we're doing that in a very disconnected way to our own detriment, we start to come back home to the body, then we can come back to integrating our higher cognitive abilities and our capacities for profound states of expanded consciousness with the experience of embodiment. And I think that's the journey, and hopefully the journey more and more of us can take together, and it can become a societal journey, which I think ultimately is what the evolution of our human species is, the trajectory that we're on. And many people all around the world are awakening in so many ways. But, you know, it's a journey. And right now, not to get political about it, but any of you that are living where I live in the U.S., we probably have the most disconnected group of lost boys running our government that's ever been around, just about, probably at least in recent times anyway. So this problem of disconnection is very much out there, but we need to keep in mind that's what we see on the news. There's also a growing movement of deep connectedness. And so they're both happening. And I actually tend to be pretty optimistic about our future. We have to figure out this climate change thing, but I'm still overall pretty optimistic, which I'm not naive. I realize there's a lot of risks and dangers, and but I'm fairly optimistic. At any rate, for me, it's this journey of coming home, coming back home. I have a friend who says that the in Western culture, the body has been relegated to the role of being just a brain taxi, something to carry around this supercomputer on our shoulders. And so I believe it's our journey. We get fascinated with that, and then at some point, we start coming home. We start coming home. But we're not divorcing ourselves from our amazing higher cognitive abilities. We're not divorcing ourselves. We're not demonizing humanity. We're not demonizing our incredible cognitive capacities. We're making use of that and actualizing higher and higher states of expanded awareness, expanded consciousness, even transcendence, but then bringing it back into the body. So it becomes embodied consciousness. So I think that's what I wanted to share in terms of this journey and this practice. And we know, I'll say one more thing and then we'll open it up. So these five neural networks, we know so much about this now from current neuroscience with various forms of neuroimaging, fMRIs and PET scans and EEGs and all kinds of different ways that we can get more data, more information about the brain and the nervous system, immunoassaying and so forth. And so we understand how these neural networks interact with each other more and more. And we know how to target them to help those neural networks become more robust, which means they're physically, they're becoming thicker. They have more neurons, more dendrites, more axons, and more interconnection, right? They're like well-worn pathways in the brain, well-lit, beautifully paved byways, right? So we can easily get to where we want to go, right? And we can target them with all kinds of body-mind practices. Now, neurosomatic mindfulness, in the way I was guiding you, it really addresses all of them. And there are different things we can add in, various forms of breath work. Just learning to breathe properly is huge. Many of us as a stress response. In fact, I was working with one amazing teacher of breath work, and somewhat kind of more in the medical field and more. And she really just she's not teaching really breath work techniques like we normally think of. She's helping people learn to breathe properly, and she says that somewhere I think it was around age 7, there's a natural shift. Well, we shift from being natural diaphragmatic breathers and belly breathers to become more vertical breathers, more chest breathers. And she described why and how that happens. It was interesting. But nonetheless, stress will exacerbate that. Because breathing this way is a stress response. And when we breathe this way, we're breathing more shallowly, and the air and the oxygen is not getting into the deeper part of the lungs where the alveoli are, where the blood oxygen exchange happens. So we're really not getting anywhere near the oxygen that we need to thrive. So we're starving the cells of oxygen. And most of us don't drink enough water. And to thrive, our cells need three things: water, H2O, oxygen, and nutrition, generally in the form of glucose. And all this supports the mitochondria, which creates the energy in the cells, every cell in the body. And so we're really starving ourselves in that way. And so learning to hydrate properly and breathe properly is really essential. And it's not just, it begins with learning to be a belly breather, right? So we feel the action of the diaphragm. So when we, everybody could do this for a moment. As you breathe in, just have your belly go out, right? And then as you breathe out, pull the belly in. Let's just really exacerbate it or exaggerate it, the belly going out and then pulling it in with the abdominal muscles. Let's just do it like three times. So you were feeling there the action of your diaphragm muscle. To some extent, as you pulled it in sharply, the abdominal muscles as well. So we want to shift to that being the main driver of the breath. And if you are a chest breather, when you go to sleep at night, and especially if you lie on your back, it's easier, but you can do it on your side. Place one hand on your chest, one hand on the belly, and just move your body around. Adjust, it's usually the position of your pelvis until you find that this hand on your chest is going up and down, and the one on the belly is fairly smooth. And then do that till you fall asleep. And within a few weeks or a few months at most, you will become a belly breather again. Why? Because we have already have the neural networks for belly breathing. It's our natural way of breathing. Right? Any of you who are parents, you remember your infant in a cradle or in the crib, belly breathing. If you have a dog or a cat at home, they're taking a nap on the living room carpet, belly breathing, right? That's our natural way of breathing. So it doesn't take that long to retrain ourselves because we already have the neural network for it, right? And once we get the momentum of that, it'll take over. But it's not just belly breathing. We bring in with the breath, but then we want to learn to open up our chest. And so we're not vertically, but laterally, sides, back, front. And over time, learning to increase the amount of air we can take in. And we're not always going to breathe deeply like that, but it's good to practice deep breathing periodically to increase the amount of air that we can take in. And for many of us, our rib cage is very constricted because we all know, and those of us, I see a lot of folks on here are similar in age and generation to myself. And we all know how stiff our muscles get, right? And tight, right? Go to a yoga class and you realize, trying to, it's not so easy, right? Well, same thing with the muscles and the connective tissue in the rib cage. It gets tight and our breath is really limited, right? So doing some deep breathing to open up those muscles in the same way we would do yoga stretching, we can stress the rib cage. And that'll be really important if we have any physical problems or have to go through a surgery or something like that. The greater our lung capacity, the greater our health in many ways. Having said that about learning to breathe properly, then there are many breath regulation techniques. You all probably know some of them, like straw breathing, where you breathe in a four count, in two, three, four through the nose with the mouth closed. And then you breathe out an eight count through pursed lips, two, three, four, five, six, seven, like that. As if you're whistling. You don't have to make a noise, but as if you're whistling. You can use an actual straw if you like. And the reason you purse the lips or use a straw is it takes more effort to breathe out through a straw or through pursed lips. And that has some impacts on exercising the diaphragm, creating vagal tone. And also the whole process changes the relationship of gases in the bloodstream, right? So, and accentuating the out-breath activates the parasympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system because the out-breath activates the parasympathetic branch. So if we're breathing out twice as long as we're breathing in, we're going to get parasympathetic activation. And learning straw breathing is very simple, and it's a great tool. I use it all the time. Anytime you're feeling a little too upregulated or anxious or anything, just do a little straw breathing. It'll bring you right back down. It's pretty magical. I teach correctional officers to use it, and they're just astounded how quickly it works and how easy it is to learn. And for the first time, they feel like they're regulating their nervous system instead of being regulated by everybody but them, which is the case for most of us. There's also 4-7-8 breathing, popularized by Andrew Weil. Same as jaw breathing, but in the middle, we put a pause for 7, right? So 4-7-8. And then there's box breathing, where we have 4 parts of the breath, in, pause, out, pause, usually a 4 count, but it could be a 5, 6. And always with breath work, we keep it very relaxed and gentle. There's no place for ambition in breath work. And then, of course, there are more transformative breath work practices. If we're going to engage in those, we need to get really good teaching and do it in safe surroundings, like Wim Hof's work or holotropic breath work or neurodynamic breath, these kind of things. That's all there. But just learning breath work for self-soothing, learning simple breath work just for self-regulation, our self-regulation network becomes more robust, right? That'll help us be with our emotional energy. You know, in basic, most classic meditation instruction, how do we work with the thoughts? Just let them be there. How do we work with our emotions? Just let them be there. We're not repressing emotions, but we're also making general effort not to be carried away by them. We're not indulging them, right? We're just being with our experience. And that general effort to be with over time increases our capacity to be with our sensate experience, to be with our emotional energy, just as it is, with openness, curiosity, and so forth. And along the way, our nervous system, which is this supercomputer learning machine, in a sense, is learning how to do all this, so it starts to become more natural, because we have a new neural architecture for it. So we move from effortful, self-directed self-regulation to auto-regulation and effortless mindfulness and effortless awareness. So that's the trajectory. And the last thing I'll say is that as we're working with, as we're living our lives, you know, and relating with the human beings in our life, or even our pets or whatever other species we might relate with, our cats and so forth, slowing down and really making a general effort to be present with others, to really listen, to tune in, to be present, to connect, to make eye contact appropriately, you know, and just training ourselves to slow down and do that more, become better listeners, become more interested in what's another person needing and feeling. Right? Tuning in that way, we develop a more robust empathy connection network. And it turns out the more deeply embodied we are, we're activating a deeper and deeper capacity for interoceptive awareness. That's the body's capacity to feel itself from the inside out. The same neural networks involved in that are becoming more robust are also involved in our ability to connect with others safely and relationally. Right? So the more embodied we are, the more we're available to the world. And the more we connect with Earth and the natural world. So all this is self-reinforcing, and all these 5 neural networks are supporting each other and all becoming more robust. And we get this synergistic impact, which then starts to look like some of the higher possibilities of human development. Okay, so with that, I will open it up to your questions. So as George said before, you can go down there where you see that little heart, click on that, and then you see a raise hand icon, and we'll see that. Okay, there's Anna. Welcome.
Hello, namaste. Anna connecting. I hope you can hear me well.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much for such a beautiful session. And I'm just, my heart is so open, and I'm just so pleased that you were talking about body and embodiment as well, because I feel our bodies are just this kind of incredible. It's just this incredible vehicle that we need if we ever want to kind of awaken and remember who we truly are. And our body is actually allowing us to do so and to deeply connect with nature and with each other and with ourselves. And it is so beautiful. I think people sometimes forget to kind of appreciate how magical our bodies actually are. And it's absolutely wonderful. So thank you very much for that. And I have a really kind of a curious question that sometimes I'm actually wondering, you know, when I sit in meditation and I feel deep connection, sometimes I have this kind of psychological kind of separation between meditation and reality afterwards, so to speak. So even though with my practice I'm more able to stay in that connectedness like for longer, but sometimes it kind of the minute I open my eyes it kind of goes away. So I'm wondering what is your actually advice how to stay connected for longer once we come out of meditation, to be connected with ourselves and with everything that's around us. Thank you so much.
That's a great question, Anna. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
And we all experience that, obviously, and really important. So how do we connect our formal practice with the rest of our life? And it'll happen organically to a degree, but it can happen in a much more accelerated way if we have more intentionality around connecting the two. It's very easy to compartmentalize our lives. Early on in my path of meditation, boy, I was good at compartmentalizing my life. I spent a lot of time in retreat and intensive practice. And then I would go into my non-practice crazy life, right? I mean, it was amazing. It's an almost schizophrenic life I was leading, right? So it's easy to compartmentalize and not connect, right? And then even if we have the intention to connect, it still, I think, requires some certain skills and so forth. So one is just the practice of presence. Just, making a commitment that I'm going to work with presence in my life. I'm going to practice present. So, every time I sit down to eat, I'm going to take a moment to be present. If my phone rings, I'm going to take a moment to breathe and be present. When I get off the phone with someone, I'm going to take a moment to be present. Before I open my computer, if I'm working or using my computer, I'm going to take a moment to breathe and be present, right? The home I share with my wife, Sophie, here we have a second floor. And so I really train myself to focus on the stairs. We have a beautiful, there was a renovation of this home before we bought it, and a beautiful staircase they put in. But no carpet on the stairs, so a little slippery. So I'm careful. I don't want to fall. And so I generally make sure I have good traction shoes or slippers on. But also just really slow down, pay attention. And so I've trained myself. Whenever I go up or down the stairs, I've trained myself well enough, but my memory kicks in and I slow down. Right? And I work with really feeling my body, feeling the muscles, feel my intention to walk up or walk down the stairs. And I do that around lots of different activities I have. Use different cues and triggers to remind myself to come back to presence. So we can work with those kind of things. Also, learning to practice with our eyes open, I think, is very helpful, right? So I just guided you an eyes closed practice, and that can be very important, but I think we also need to learn to practice with our eyes open. In my regular practice, I practice with my eyes open almost all the time. And I've been trained in that kind of practice. But I do it. I'm still deeply embodied because I've been training in this kind of embodiment for many, many decades, right? But if we learn to practice with our eyes open, there's a more natural transition, right, in our life. Also, practices like walking meditation, in the Zen tradition and others, where we're obviously we have our eyes open and we're walking, but we're practicing with being present and mindful, right? So those kind of practices can help us transition. I want to give everyone here, though, a quick little practice, and let's just go ahead and do it. So I invite everyone, I'm going to invite you to close your eyes for a moment, and then I'll lead us through a four-step process, and on the final one, we'll open our eyes and just kind of open out into the visual field, right? So So with your eyes closed, just let yourself get stirred up about something. Think about things you have to do later, things you haven't gotten done, pressures at work, conflicts in your life, relational stuff, things you're upset about, pissed off about, worried about. Just let your mind get stirred up. Just go ahead and let your mind get all stirred up. And then listen to me, and you can repeat the words I say. It'll just be single words. You can repeat them and just kind of do what I'm saying. But first, let your mind get all stirred up. Stop. Feel. Breathe. And be. And with that, opening your eyes, extending your awareness out into the environment and the world. So the practice is the practice of stop, feel, breathe, and be. So stop is the pattern interrupt. So you just silently say to yourself, stop. You don't have to have your eyes closed to do it, but can you stop? And then feel, just feel whatever you're feeling, even if it's anxiety or anger or sadness or just, you know, mind all caught up in things or the pressures of the day. Just let yourself feel what you're feeling. Not trying to get rid of feelings. Really, let yourself feel whatever you're feeling. And remember to breathe so you're not, you know, like holding and constricting. And then just relax into a moment of being, pure presence. So let's try it again, okay? So closing your eyes, letting yourself get all stirred up about things, thinking about this, thinking about that, thinking about those things you got to do later. You know, feel that sense of busyness and anxiety and stress, and then stop. Feel. Breathe. And be. So that's a little micro practice you all can take with you, and I encourage you to do that throughout your day. And it begins to permeate, you know, we're very much involved in doing, right? Our whole culture is about doing, doing, doing. And people, we don't usually get a paycheck for being, right? So, but we can learn to permeate our doing with more being, and thus our lives will be much more resourced and healthier and happier and so forth. So thank you, Anna. So, Lena.
Hello. Hoping that you can hear me, even though I'm in a mild environment. Is it okay?
Barely.
I love the practice. Thank you. I thought it was interesting. You talked about the default mode work. And I've always heard about it and never quite understood how it related to everything. And I'm just hoping to summarize whether I heard you correctly, where it's sort of like when we sit, mind wanders. And we're often seen as sort of a negative thing by some because we tend to bias the negative when the wandering happens or ourselves. So our goal as meditators is to try to help train the brain to instead bias the positive, and then the default mode network becomes more creative. I'm curious about the clarification of how that works.
We don't have that background because your background sounds a little bit like my default mode network. So, yeah, and you're kind of talking about two different paradigms there, okay? With the practice of meditation, we're really training our attention. So we're not trying to develop the non-fear-based default mode network for creativity. That's a different paradigm. It's a different project, if you will, different practice. Here, we're simply really working with feeling the body ever more deeply in order to activate the task positive network. So the default mode network naturally goes offline, which increases attention stabilization and gives us access to deeper states of awareness, deeper states of interoceptive awareness and healing and awakening, right? So that's what we're doing here. Now, there can be other practices where you learn to be in that mind wandering state without fear. And that's fine, but that's a different kind of practice. That's actually what happens in psychoanalysis, where, you know, a patient with a psychoanalyst, you know, they create a beautiful office, a couch, you know, and they create an environment where the person lies and eventually feels safe and secure enough they can let their mind wander. And instead of going into fear and anxiety, it goes into free association. It could be access to dream states and the unconscious and all that kind of thing, right? Or musicians, artists, you know, may be able to access that kind of mind-wandering, dreamy state where they'll discover new songs, new melodies, or a visual art, or even scientists. You know, I've often the greatest discovery. What was it? Was it who was it that discovered the great thing while in the bathtub? Was that Archimedes? I think he was discovered. You know, one of the great discoveries is while relaxing in the bathtub, right? So, but that's a whole different project. With mind training and meditation, we're not demonizing the default mode network, but we're just learning how to regulate it. So it starts to go offline and we have greater attention stabilization. Now there's some parallels between this and other things. The scientists who have been exploring and researching various forms of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, they feel that part of the healing mechanism is that psychedelics take the default mode network offline to a degree. There's also intense forms of breath work like holotropic breath work, neurodynamic breath work. And those, they feel part of the mechanism there is that they take the the Baltimore network off to a degree. Also, it takes us out of the kind of network of our kind of narcissistic preoccupation and our limited self. That's why people often have these profound experiences of interconnectedness and oneness and so forth on self-transcendence when the Baltimore network is less active. But for us, it's much simpler than all that. For us, we're just really wanting to train our attention and stabilize our attention so we can be present. Great. Thank you. Good question. Let's go to Dawn.
Well, thank you very much. I hope I can ask this question. I was wondering, I'm in the health field, so I've been studying what I call spirituality, and because we don't really address it in the health field. And so I kind of have learned to think of it as mind, body, and spirit so that others can understand it. And because I think that what we don't talk about is the spiritual aspects of a person and when we have disease or other things that happen to us. And I think that in our younger generation in America, that the spirit, I mean, nobody actually is addressing the spirit. So it's kind of getting lost in the younger generation. But I think that I've been really struggling, well, really working on finding an anchor. And so things like the practice of saying, you know, go to a place of love, you know, that life is about love, and go to the one that knows, which is the heart. And then the other thing is that love is truth. And that when you go away from the truth, it becomes illusions. And then maybe delusions, that's what I'm exploring. But I think today was the first time I heard about going to the body. Because I think of the body as when people actually let their bodies control them. And then it becomes, in the health field, it becomes kind of a somatic world. Because that's what's appropriate. It's like, I have pain in my body. You kind of say, I have pain in my spirit. Or, you know, it's not an accepted thing. And so what I notice that people are saying is that what I've noticed is the physical pain, that they'll say, I don't feel good. My body feels heavy. I need to go to urgent care. I need to go to the hospital. You know, these kind of things are happening more and more. So I was just wondering, I was just really interested in how to use going to the body.
Yeah.
In the concept that you're bringing. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question, Dawn. And you're really kind of talking about this whole trajectory of materialistic Western science, right? And so, and very often for a lot of us, the return to the body is many times not easy. Because we may regard our body as a place of suffering. We're experiencing physical pain. Maybe we have physical ailments and various things going on. Or it's where our trauma resides. And going into the body can trigger very difficult things. And so we always have to approach it with gentleness. There are some wonderful modalities out there like somatic experiencing, Peter Levine's work, where we titrate that experience and what's called pendulating, where we're leaning in a little bit, but if things become unworkable, we lean back to some place where we feel okay. Lean in, lean out, lean in, lean out. Bessel van Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score, is absolutely phenomenal book of understanding trauma. So there's all those kind of things. But we have associated the body with being non-spiritual, right? That's part of the whole Western tradition, that the body, even within the religious traditions, and that's why many of the religious traditions, East and West, tended to denigrate the body as the source of lust and pain and hunger and all the lower human kind of desires and so forth, right? And tend to demonize the body. But actually, there's absolutely no separation between body and spirit. That's completely illusory, right? The body is consciousness. Our whole reality is consciousness, all made up of bits of consciousness. And spirit is a Western term, comes from the Greek, and it generally references the non-material, right? And for some, it can reference a sense of the sacred or deity or God, right? But it's the non-material. And both Eastern and Western science, we're getting to where the non-material is much more accessible to us, what used to be considered non-material. So many of the alternative medical therapies like acupressure and acupuncture and different kinds of energy medicine are working with the flow of chi or life force energy in the body, or in Japanese it's called ki, as in Aikido. In Sanskrit it's prana, and the Tibetan tradition it's lung, right? And now we have some scientific instruments that can actually measure this and can measure the radiation of energy from the heart center and so forth. So we're getting closer and closer, and there's a whole emerging field of biofield science. So the biofield is something we're beginning to be able to scientifically measure and observe. So it's not so much the non-material anymore, because we're able to observe, we're able to measure, right? Now, eventually consciousness, most worldwide traditions, as well as East and West and quantum theory, there is a kind of a ultimate field of consciousness, which is unmanifest and pure potentiality, which actually probably is the source out of which all this arises. But a lot of which was previously relegated to the world spirit is now things that we can experience, life force energy, chi, prana, and things like this. Light in the body. We are beings of light. The most essential, photon is really one of the most essential elements of reality and of our bodies. And actually our bodies, even at the cellular level, the mitochondria, the engines of energy in the cells, each cell in the body, they produce a weak light, a photon light. So it's called biophotons, right? So we're learning a lot more about this, right? And for me, the body, see, we can have transcendent experiences by escaping the body, taking a psychedelic medicine. Nothing wrong with having those, but it's kind of this quick escape, or intense kinds of breath work, or in various traditions, they used to beat the body, starve themselves, do all kinds of things to try to escape the body into these expanded states of consciousness. And it's not that those aren't valid experiences, but if we can't bring them back to the body, they don't serve us much. In fact, they can just inflate the ego, basically. But we can also have all those same experiences by going into the body. Because the body, we start relating with it as this kind of gross physical sensation, very tangible. But the deeper we go, it becomes more subtle sensation and subtler and subtler. And then it becomes what was called subtle body in the yogic traditions, Taoism, the Vedic traditions, with subtle body, which now we're into the realm of what usually would be called spirit, subtle body, subtle energy, life force energy, prana, and into the very depths of being, even beyond. So we can go all the way. We can go all the way into the most profound states through the body. And by doing it through the body, in the process, we're transforming the neural architecture of the brain and nervous system. So now the body knows how to get there and can live there and abide there. And we don't have to divorce our bodies to be spiritual anymore. Right, and this has really been much more the pathway of indigenous peoples forever. But and that's not to demonize non-indigenous or whether we're all on this human journey together, and we live in an amazing time where we have access to so much knowledge, current science, quantum science, biofield science, network neuroscience, as well as all the ancient yogic science, indigenous wisdom, contemplative wisdom. We have all of it available, so it's an amazing time. So, Mark, this will be the last question, I think.
Thanks. During the meditation, you went through three things, feeling safe, and then something and connected. What was
these two?
Yeah, and I was noticing real difficulty finding that in myself, finding safety, finding resourcing. And I think maybe it's because I'm using my mind to try and find it, but I'm curious about whether that was that a practice that was speaking to the body, or was it speaking to the mind, or
it's very much speaking to the body, although body and mind are not separate, right? They're not separate at all, but it's speaking to the body. We're really working with three parts of the brain there. right? We have what's called a reptilian brain. It's at the top of the brainstem, which is just about keeping us alive. It's all about survival, right? And when that clicks in, we go into survival mode on autopilot, right? Then we have the midbrain, the limbic brain, which is about lots of things, processing memory and language and decision-making, because we're emotional decision-makers. It's all about our emotions. But it's also where the alarm bells are that trigger the whole fight or flight response, right? We have the midbrain, and then we have the amazing forebrain, the human brain, higher cognitive abilities. But also those three parts, the reptilian brain is all about survival. The midbrain is about approaching getting our needs met for food, warmth, shelter, and procreation. And the higher brain about many, all our higher cognitive abilities, but also our ability to maintain complex social interactions, be part of a family, a community, so a team. So we're kind of speaking to those three parts of the brain, inviting them to relax and come into a harmonic flow. And that practice is an adaptation with permission from some similar things that Rick Hansen does. It's a little different, but based on some of his work, Dr. Rick Hansen, I highly recommend his work. But in terms of being resourced, can you think of a time, just ordinary, when you feel particularly resourced?
I can, I guess, and it's probably like goes to last thing about connected, when I'm feeling connected with someone or with a community. I guess I'm feeling that way. I think maybe it's because right now I'm not feeling that way and my brain is spinning with that.
How about just when you've had a good night's rest? You wake up, maybe you've had a good night's rest and things are basically okay, maybe, maybe your partner, if you have one, is already has the coffee brewing, you smell the coffee, whatever it is for you, there's just a feeling of okayness and, the bills are paid, you have a home, you're there, you're grounded, rested, it's just a quality of being physically resourced.
I'm just in a place in my life at the moment where it feels hard to find that.
So one way to work with that, and I encourage all of us to work with this, if you can, in your meditation practice, especially going deep into the body and even doing body scans, right? Doing a body scan practice where you scan up from the soles of your feet all the way to the crown of your head and through the arms as well. Or if anyone's practiced the kind of yoga nidra style body scanning, right? And just really take that approach deep into the body and just be curious about memories arising of when you did feel safe. Or you did feel really resourced. Or you did feel really connected. And over time, memories may arise that go quite a bit way back in our childhood. Many of us may feel like I never felt safe in my childhood. I never felt connected. Now, many of us did, perhaps. We had, parents that weren't totally checked out or weren't, but for many of us, but we can rediscover these experiences and then, be with that. Yeah, I remember what that was. Wow, I felt really safe and embraced. I was, it could have been a child. I'm there, my mom made hot chocolate and I was watching my favorite cartoons and I was sitting with my brothers and sisters sitting on the couch. It could be anything, a moment when we just really felt safe and resourced and connected. It could be a moment in nature. So, sort of allowing these experiences to arise as we're working with deep embodiment and then just, as they arise, then we can recognize them and kind of dwell on them, savor them, feel them, and remember them. And if we really connect with them, then they're ours. And they're markers we can always come back to. That, yeah, and maybe right now I don't feel very connected. I don't feel very resourced, but I know what that is. Yeah, can I stop? Okay, I know what that feels like. I can re-regulate my nervous system into that experience of feeling safe, resource and connected. And then whatever's going in my life, I'm going to deal with it better from that place than if I try to deal with my life from a place of, I'm not connected, I'm not resourced, I don't know what I'm doing, But if I can stop and come back, find those experiences. So I can't remember her name, I don't see her right now, but asked about that Tipalmo network. So that's a practice where we could, really work with working our way into feeling really embodied, doing some kind of body scanning, something like the neurosomatic mindfulness or something like yoga nidra. And then to the extent that we're stabilized in that, you know, then we could let the mind wander a little bit without losing that embodiment, right? And working with that edge of the mind wandering, the embodiment. And that's where those memories may pop up, especially if we have this basic inquiry about, what are some times when maybe I did feel really safe, or I did feel really resourced, or I did feel really connected. And then if they arise, then just really spending a little time with that and appreciating that. Remember the colors, remember the detail, remember what it was like. And those will imprint. And those can be very positive memories and experiences that can balance out what's in our long-term memory, which is mostly memories of danger and risk and fear and so forth. Yeah.
Thank you.
Find that helpful, Mark. And yeah.
Thanks.
You know, there's another practice that we're out of time, but there's another prayer, you know, I wanted to just mention, I was talking about this a little before. We now know there's lots of body mind techniques we can use to target these different neural networks. And in many cases, in a synergistic way, but we can target very specific ones. We can just work right on attention, or we can work with emotion, right? But they'll all interconnect anyway. But one practice is tapping. I don't know if people are familiar with tapping or emotional freedom technique, where you're tapping on the sides of your hand. Like here, fine, and like here. There are these acupressure points. That's what they are. They're acupressure points. Right? And when we're tapping, right, and, you know, here and so forth, top of the head. So as we're doing that, many often what we do is, if we're feeling anxious or stressed, we can just acknowledge that. Okay, I'm feeling really stressed out while I'm tapping. And we can tap while we acknowledge what we're actually feeling. And over time, we'll find ourselves re-regulating, right? We're not denying what's going on. We're acknowledging what we're feeling, but we're tapping, and over time we're regulating and regulating and regulating. And then we can say, okay, yeah, I am kind of feeling it, but I choose to be resourced. I choose to feel safe. I choose as we're tapping, right? And there's one I do, which is kind of a priming practice to prime certain states. Because when we spend ourselves in certain states, like think of positive states, like peace, equanimity, gratitude, forgiveness, right? These are positive. The more time we spend in those states, our brain is, our neural architecture is changing. We're developing neural networks that know how to abide in those states. So they go from being temporary states to more like traits. If we practice gratitude, we become a great person. If we practice being happy, we can become a happy person, right? So, but on the other hand, if we're practicing being anxious and practicing being depressed and practicing being angry, well, that's what that leads to, right? So there's one priming practice I do while I'm tapping. I'm just, and work, the ideal breath rhythm is 6 seconds in, 6 seconds out. We know that from current neurals. It's actually 5.5 in and 5.5 out, but I do, 6 is easier. So it's like 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, 1,004, 1,005, 1,006 on the in-breath. See, that's much slower than most of us breathe, right? So I'm breathing at that rate. And then I chose 6 words to each one be represent a second, right? And so I tap as I'm going, love, healing, gratitude, forgiveness, peace, and bliss. Love, healing, gratitude, forgiveness, peace, and bliss. Love, healing, gratitude, forgiveness, peace, and bliss. And I'm basically priming those states. And after I do that for a while, I'm feeling in a state of those, you know, this very state of grace and joy that's full of gratitude and forgiveness and peace and so forth, and actually even become, can become blissful. And in doing so, I'm reshaping my neural architecture so that becomes to pervade my life more, rather than my life being pervaded with a sense of entitlement or being pissed off or anxious or angry and ungrateful and the rest of it. Yeah. We are the masters of our own ship, so to speak, if we choose to do so or to be so. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for hosting us, George, and thank you all for showing up today. It's always a blessing to be with fellow practitioners and fellow humans on this amazing hero's journey that we're all on.